Hello again. Oh, these lights are bright up here. So welcome to our final session of Mind Science. And our first speaker this afternoon is Kevin Siebold, who's the Chair of Psychology at Grove City College, and he's going to be talking about cultural cognition.
Before I forget, I want to make sure that I say that I prepared a bibliography if anyone's interested down here in the front row after the session. Well, as we're all well aware, there seems to be a lot of examples of division in our country, and I just want to go through a few. I could spend 20 minutes talking about all the different examples of division, perhaps, but up here we have on the left the young man from Louisiana who was recently killed, and the one on the right, the young man from Minnesota. And then at the bottom, of course, the sort of a memorial that was made in honor of the slain policeman in Dallas a couple of weeks ago. On the left, the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And then on the right, or farther back, a few years ago, events in Ferguson that have sort of brought forth the Black Lives Matter movement. So some have suggested, and there is some evidence I just want to look at here briefly, that America is becoming more and more polarized, particularly in the last 20 years. Now, there is some disagreement about exactly how polarized Americans are, particularly along the political dimension. Certainly, we're not as polarized as we have been perhaps in the past. We can think of the mid-19th century as a time when we were really severely polarized. And so certainly it's not to that extreme. But if we look at the last 20 years or maybe even 40 years, it seems like we're less civil along political lines than perhaps we used to be. So I want to look at a few, a little bit of data from this one is from the Pew Research Center. And this one shows over the last 20 years how we're becoming more and more polarized again politically. So this shows us here on the left, 94 to 2014. The median position of Democrats in the blue and then the red Republican. And so we see that the medians have separated over the years. And also we have larger percentages that are consistently conservative or consistently liberal on the left-hand side of this figure. We see this a little bit more clearly perhaps here, where this one here, no, you can't read it from the distance we are, but it says that 92% of Republicans are more conservative than the median Democrat. That's that point. And then down below, 94% of Democrats are more liberal than the median Republican. And not only are, according to the Pew polls, we becoming more polarized along that sort of dimension, here we have Democratic attitudes about the Republican Party. And what we have here from, again, 20 years, 94 to 2014, we have 38% of the Democrats having a very unfavorable view of the Republican Party, and 79% a unfavorable view. So 79%, almost 80% having an unfavorable view, and of that group, 38% very unfavorable. Then on the other, 82% of Republicans have an unfavorable view of the Democratic Party, and then of that group, 43% having a very unfavorable view. The unfavorableness even extends to dislike of the other party. So on the left, we have 27% of Democrats see the Republican Party as a threat to the nation's well-being, and on the right, 36% of Republicans see the Democratic Party as a threat to the nation's well-being. So this, not just a disagreement, but that the views of the opposing party are a threat to the perhaps very existence of the country itself. Again, that's changed from 94 to 2014 over a 20-year period. And then these are just a few other, those previous ones came from Pew. This comes from the American Values Survey, again, Pew Research. It bothers me when I come into contact with immigrants who speak little or no English. Again, this is just in a 3-year period from 2012 to 2015, and the percent who agree with that in 2012 was about 40%, 57% disagree. By 2015, it was about 50-50. That bothers me when they come into contact with immigrants who speak little or no English. Here, this one, again, American Values Survey, the values of Islam are at odds with American values and way of life. And we see at the top, all Americans, and that number is 56% agree with that statement, 41% disagree. White evangelical Protestants, the percentage drops up, jumps up to 73% agree with that statement. Non-Christian religion, the percentage is 37%. And you see in between their unaffiliated Black Protestant, Catholic, white mainline Protestant, the percentages that represent that position. This figure is today's discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. And all Americans, 55% disagree with that statement, 43% agree. But as you look at Tea Party, Republican, Independent, and Democrat, you see the percentages are quite diverse. 68% Tea Party agreeing with that, 71% Democrats disagreeing with that view, and 64% Republicans agreeing with that view. And then this one deals with, do you think the recent killings of African American men by police are isolated incidents, or are they part of a broader pattern of how police treat African Americans? All Americans, 53% isolated incidents, white, non-Hispanic, 65% say that it's isolated, Hispanic, 59% say it's part of a broader pattern, black, 81% see that it's part of a broader pattern. So not only are we becoming perhaps more politically diverse, we are developing a number of polarizations along important cultural issues. And the term ideological silos has been used to describe down-the-line consistency on all political, social, and cultural issues. And it seems like more and more Americans are deciding to select their friends, where they're going to live, based upon the beliefs of those people who live in a particular neighborhood. So again, from 94 to 2014, growing minority holds consistent ideological views. Thing to note here is that the middle is becoming lower and the extremes, consistently liberal or consistently conservative, becoming larger over, again, a 20-year period. This refers to these ideological echo chambers. The one on the left is important for me to live in a place where most people share my political views. So consistently conservative, people who report consistently conservative views, 50% of those say yes, it is important to me to live in a place where people share my political views. Consistently liberal, 35% say that. Most of my close friends share my political views. Again, consistently conservative, 63%, consistently liberal, 49%, almost half. So these are issues that, just some of the issues that we face today. And I think it's interesting to note that for the most part, not all the time, of course, but for the most part, if you know that a person is a political conservative, you can pretty much identify what their views are going to be on these issues. They're going to tend to be pro-life, pro-death penalty, anti-gun control, against same-sex marriage, again, tend to be skeptical about climate change and evolutionary theory, people who identify as political liberals are going to tend to be pro-choice, anti-death penalty, pro-gun control, for same-sex marriage, more accepting of scientific consensus regarding climate change and evolutionary theory. And then there are obviously other issues, GMO organisms, healthcare, nuclear power, etc. But the question I think that is of interest is, why is there a pattern on these sorts of issues? Many of them have political data to, or at least ostensibly have political data to indicate whether or not the climate is actually changing, or whether or not the death penalty really does reduce violent crime. So there seems to be no logical connection between a person's position on the death penalty and same-sex marriage, and yet they do coalesce together. So why is there this pattern? Well, I want to talk just a little bit about something we heard a very excellent talk earlier today by Justin Barrett, dealing with dual process theory. So we have these two types of cognition. Type one goes by a variety of names: intuitive, natural, non-reflective. Type two cognition is rational, unnatural, reflective. So essentially, type one cognition is what Justin was talking about primarily this morning. It's automatic, it doesn't take any effort. It is often and is generally occurring at a non-conscious level. Type two cognition takes effort. It is involving reflection, and it's unnatural in that it's not the natural type one sort of cognition that we heard about this morning. So type one cognition, or natural cognition, occurs when, without reflection, we grasp something complex about the environment. So we immediately learn something, often more than what's readily apparent. So if we look at these faces, we immediately, without any conscious effort at all, without any sort of reflection or conscious thought, know what these people, child, the two women or the man, what they're feeling. We might have immediate thoughts about what they are, what their beliefs are, what their thoughts are. We might also have some intuitions about what they might do in the very near future. So that is an example of the kind of cognition that type one cognition provides us. These are examples taken from Kahneman and his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, a very good book about these two types of cognition. One very fast, type one, one slow, type two. So these are some of the things that we might do, or that type one cognition might allow us to accomplish. And these are ones that type two cognition, the slower type of cognition, would be used to accomplish these sorts of tasks. Well, we have beliefs that derive from type 1 and type 2 cognition. And we heard, again, in Justin's talk earlier today about essentially examples of type 1 beliefs. And we see some listed there. These are intuitive, they're familiar, they arrive early in development, as we learned earlier today, and they're seen as normal and they're ubiquitous. All people, including very young children, begin to have these kinds of beliefs. There are also beliefs coming from type 2 cognition, the more reflective type. And we see some examples here as well. The third one there, there are three persons in the Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is just meant to illustrate that while Justin was talking about type 1 religious beliefs, like the belief in gods, the particular kind of God, like the God of Judeo-Christianity, or of Christianity, that there is a Godhead, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, that's an example of a theological or reflective belief. It takes effort and education to come up with that sort of belief, even though the belief in God itself is something that is more of a type one belief. So with that little bit of review of type 1 and type 2 cognition, I want to look at cultural cognition here for a moment. So cultural cognition consists of a set of processes whereby what a person believes about an issue derives from their cultural commitments or values. and culture tends to come before fact. That is to say, one's adoption of a particular cultural perspective shapes what that person is going to believe about an issue. So incoming empirical data may not really change a person's view because their view is adopted on the basis of these cultural values or these cultural commitments. So the more evidence or information one gets is not necessarily going to change these beliefs. So in this way, cultural commitments act as a kind of heuristic for assessing evidence on issues. And a heuristic is a thinking strategy that allows us to be more efficient in making our decisions, but with some increased possibility of mistakes, versus an algorithm which leads to fewer errors but takes more time to arrive at the decision. So regular citizens are not in a position to know for themselves, for example, whether climate is really changing, or if gun control really does reduce violent crime, or if evolutionary theory is really the best explanation of speciation. Regular citizens have to depend upon information that we get from other people. And psychological processes of cultural cognition lead us to listen to and depend on information we get from those we trust. And we trust those who share our cultural commitments, our beliefs, our values. We find that information more credible, more believable. So these are a couple of examples of heuristics that act at the cognitive level, cognitive heuristics, you might say. So the availability heuristic. What we think about a topic is influenced by how easily evidence to support a particular position comes to mind. So many people are afraid of flying, even though statistically flying is very safe. But many people would rather drive than fly to a particular place. And part of the reason for that is that it's very easy to come up with an example, a memory, of a plane crash that killed 300 people or so. We can easily come up with that sort of memory, and that ease at which we come up with that memory tends to bias us to think that that's a more dangerous kind of travel than riding in a car, because it's not easy to come up with an example of mass injuries or mass people who have been killed in car accidents. It's easier to come up with the example from flying. So information in this context I'm talking about today, information is going to be more easily retrieved as it comes from a person who holds similar cultural commitments that I do. So if I know that a person has the same values that I have, the same commitments that I have, it's going to be easier for me to remember what that person has said in the past than it is for me to remember what someone who thinks differently than I do, what they have said in the past about a particular issue. Biased assimilation, as you see here, is a tendency to accept the reliability of new information if it conforms to what I already think is true, and to reject information that is inconsistent with what I already believe. So if I believe that the death penalty reduces the violent crime rate, information to the contrary is very likely to be rejected by me. It's not going to be reliable because it's not consistent with what I think is true. Naive realism. Beliefs held by my cultural group will be seen as a result of objective assessment of the evidence. Beliefs from individuals of other cultural groups, they're biased. I'm not, but they are, of course. And reactive devaluation. Individuals in one group dismiss the persuasiveness of evidence presented by different cultural groups. So evidence presented by a Christian might be seen as more persuasive than evidence provided by a Muslim or an unbeliever, because of group membership. I'm going to trust the Christian more so than an atheist, or more so perhaps than someone in another religious group. Motivated cognition is the tendency of individuals to conform evaluations of information to be consistent with a goal or purpose besides accuracy. So it's not necessarily the case that these cognitive processes are only looking at or only intended to provide accurate information. We want and do, it turns out, evaluate information to the extent that it is consistent with what we already hold to be true. So we're motivated to be biased in these sorts of ways. So in this context, I want to talk about in-groups and out-groups a little bit. So if a person's identity is tied to membership in a group, a political party, a religious denomination, then that is going to tend to shape that person's, that identity is going to be perhaps threatened if they do not hold the same beliefs as the other people in the group. So I want to quickly here in closing talk about or mention World Foundations Theory. This is a work by Jonathan Haidt. And if you go to yourmorals.org, you can see a little bit of what he's trying to do. But what he has identified is that there are these moral foundations, six of them: care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, sanctity. And most of our decisions, even moral decisions, tend to be made at the type one cognitive level, non-conscious, non-reflective. And self-identified political liberals tend to emphasize care and fairness, less the other four. Self-identified political conservatives tend to utilize all four, all six more equally. And so, sort of in closing here, how might we be able to, instead of talking past each other, talk more effectively to a person who perhaps does not agree with us on a lot of these issues? And Haidt's work suggests that what we need to do is to appeal to the other person's moral foundations. So, for example, if you want to convince someone that your view is better than theirs, it's not going to be really effective to appeal to reason, because probably they did not adopt their position on the basis of type two reflective thought. They've adopted it on the basis of type one non-reflective thought. So you need to appeal to their emotions. You need to appeal to these moral foundations. And I think that's part of the reason why these positions on different issues tend to group together, is because of the effect of these moral foundations that it has on each of us. So intergroup contact, appeal to the moral foundations of the outgroup, present information in a way that doesn't threaten the other side's values, to respect the moral foundations from which they are coming from. So I'll close with this quote by President Obama. As frustration grows, there will be voices urging us to fall back to the tribes, to scapegoat fellow citizens who don't look like us, or pray like us, or vote like we do, or share the same background. We can't afford to go down that path. So I think cultural cognition is one way of perhaps helping us to talk to each other instead of talking past each other. Thank you.
Of questions?
Yes.
Do you think perhaps appealing to emotion and perhaps things that can lead to scare tactics, emotion-based arguments as opposed to reason-based arguments, violates some ancient philosophical understanding of discourse and what, especially political discourse, is supposed to look like? Because that goes all the way back to Plato and Aristotle setting up what rhetoric is, mm-hmm. reasoned argument, effectively. And then I would like to think that there's a reason they didn't go for emotional arguments instead.
Well, I think that in addition to using reasoned argument, we have to, at least Haidt would argue, that you have to begin at the intuitive level. He would argue that primarily, we make decisions quickly, even moral decisions, even decisions on some of these issues. We make them quickly using type one cognition. And then after the fact, we come up with reasons to justify those decisions. So again, if you want to change someone's opinion, you really have to get at their intuitions. And then perhaps, after the fact, provide good reasons for why they should have those intuitions. You have to really get at the intuitions first.
Well, we're talking politics, and there's not more questions.
With respect to the polarization and political perspective, Democrat and Republican, do you think that one wing may have moved more than another wing with respect to moving away from the center?
One,
what? Has the Republican Party moved more right than has the Democratic Party moved left, or vice versa?
Well, the Pew data suggests that it's pretty much equal. And I should add that the Pew data don't reflect the views of the majority of Americans, but they do reflect, it seems, the view of the people who are most engaged in the political process, that that's where the polarization seems to be taking place. If you're asking me personally, I think that there's one that's moved more than the other, but I don't know that I'm justified in saying that and thinking that by the data. My intuition is.
Hearing.
Is the polarization really a bad thing, or does it open the door for a broader discussion?
I'm sorry, is polarization bad?
Yeah, is it really kind of bad, or is it just opening our door for, you know, because we've got these extreme views, but we can also discuss these extreme views just like we're doing now?
Yeah, I think if we take the time and effort to engage in discussions, not necessarily a bad thing, but I think we might all get the sense anyway that there's not much discussion going on these days, or perhaps not as much as we would like. I think perhaps not as much as there was, you know, in the 1970s in Congress, for example, where Democrats and Republicans, you know, they had their differences of opinion, and then to the 80s as well, but they could sit down and, you know, hash things out. Haidt argues that part of the reason why that doesn't happen today is because representatives, senators perhaps to a lesser extent, but members of the House, they tend to remain in their congressional districts. They don't move to Washington to bring their families. And so there's less opportunity for members of Congress to see each other in a social setting, you know, at the, you know, school play, at the soccer games, where you can get to know each other on a more personal, you know, not professional basis. He suggests that that's part of the reason why there's less compromise and discussion, because they don't know each other personally. They just know each other as antagonists who, as some of the data suggest, their views are actually threatened or are seen as threatening to the country's well-being.
Could I add?
Excuse me?
Yes.
I've been in Europe, and this tendency of polarization is there, and I'm now living in South Africa. Don't you think that it is, the explanation is rather an increase in individualism and hedonism? Because everybody's looking after themselves.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to suggest that this is a, and I don't think Haidt would either, this is the whole story. There's other forces and factors at work. I think it's also clear that over the years, we, in this country, become more individualistic in our thinking, less communal. I think that's true as well.
Thank you very much.